And California weed is kick-ass fucking weed. This is weed that even Jamaicans go, oh, don't smoke that weed, man. It's California catatonic. It's the type of weed you hit it and it's like, fuck. I'm not doing something. What is it? All right, breathe. And you get so stoned, you end up sitting on your couch for a week to the point where your cat's going, get up, you asshole. I've been eating my own shit for the last 2 days. I know mellow, but this is fucking ridiculous.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. That was, voice of Robin Williams, who died last week. Shocking everyone, of course, shocking the world. Maybe those who knew him best were less shocked by his decision to commit suicide as a result of his depression. Now more news has since come out that Robin was in the first stages of battling Parkinson's disease. How much this played into his decision, no one knows, whatever. It's just a tragedy all around. And my first of the two guests on this episode is the journalist Glenn Kenny, and we talk about Robin and his career. But I did want to start the show recognizing the loss of this tremendous actor, comedian, person who, like, we all grew up with, you know, and whose career was, like, unparalleled, practically, at least in this country. Was he the greatest actor in the world? No. Was he the greatest comic in the world? Possibly. But there's something about his contribution that just affected everybody in a very positive way. And I miss him. It's just terribly, terribly sad. 63, Robin Williams. But we'll talk with Glenn a little bit about Robin in a few minutes. I just want to say Glenn is a journalist, a blogger. He has a very popular blog called Some Came Running, and has a new book called Robert De Niro, The Portrait of an Actor, which is part of a series of books. It's just became available, and so Glenn came on to hawk his book, for basically speaking. No, I invited him. I pursued him. I saw him speak about his book. He did a multimedia presentation at Videology in Brooklyn a few weeks ago, and I asked him on the show. He did such a great job talking about Robert De Niro and giving it so much context. And so, and one of the films, interestingly enough, is in the films that he elaborates on is in the De Niro pantheon is Awakenings, you know, which of course he co-starred with Robin Williams. So it's interesting, and it comes up in the course of our conversation. So I was kind of grappling whether to include this segment today on this particular episode, because it's kind of somber. This episode, number 233 of the podcast, and that is in a conversation I had with filmmaker Jennifer Crute, who has a new documentary on the actor and activist George Takei. George, of course, played Lieutenant Sulu in the Star Trek series, went on to play, of course, the character in many movies through the 80s and 90s, and then came out of the closet as a gay actor. It turns out he's also very, very involved in speaking about his experience as a young boy, and he and his family living through Japanese internment camps here in the United States during World War II. And he still speaks about it. And he travels the world at this stage. He's a phenomenon. His postings on Facebook are, of course, infamous. He is a funny, warm guy. And I got to meet him very briefly a few weeks ago on the cruise. We had a screening of the film, and I got to talk to Jennifer. I unfortunately was not able, as of yet anyway, to talk to George Takei himself. But if that happens, I'll include it on a future episode of the show. But here is again my conversation with Glenn, and then we'll come back and we'll be talking with the filmmaker Jennifer Crute, who made this documentary called To Be Takei, which premiered at Sundance and has been is about to come out theatrically. Glenn Kenny, thank you for coming on.
Hey, my pleasure.
You know,
thank you for having me.
That was a great event, by the way. The Videology that
The Videology thing was pretty nicely put together. I liked their idea for it, and having the opportunity to talk about De Niro's work with the help of clips, some of them specifically tailored to what I'd written about in the book, was a lot of fun, and people seem to receive it well. Maybe take it on the road sometime.
Yeah, no, totally. I thought you were doing something like that. Well, you know, it doesn't have to be quite so small as Videology, because that's a small room.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's say to double that size, and what you have is a concentration of people that are really, you know, pretty much geeks. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, diehards, people that really like to talk about it, whether it's they're into De Niro or just like to discuss movies on that level.
Sure.
So I do think there is that would probably find some success. You actually wanted to start by acknowledging that the last few weeks there have been this unusual number of really well-known and beloved people who have passed away.
Yeah.
or, you know, died from one circumstance or another, going back to, I guess, James Garner.
Yeah, it's been a rough summer for mortality. James Garner, the death of Robin Williams, the death of Lauren Bacall, some lesser-known character actors, Ed Nelson, was it?
I don't remember him, but...
A few other people, yeah. It's Robin Williams' death has the most... really kind of...
resonance.
Gut punch,
for sure.
Impact.
Yeah. Right. Well, of course, Lauren Bacall lived a long life, as did Garner. Williams, yeah, it's just sort of... It stings, you know. It stings, even though I didn't know him, never met him, but it stings because you feel like you do. Somebody, you've been watching somebody, you know, your book is, it's a similar experience where you have somebody like De Niro that takes on this meaning in your life as they, you know, they're just part of your landscape, as you said.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I talked about it on a couple of radio shows the other day, and I mentioned that for a lot of people younger than myself, you know, Robin Williams almost became an uncle or father figure. He's someone who's been there, kind of present in the popular culture of their lives since they've been alive. You know, there was never not a time when Robin Williams wasn't a big deal. I was in my late teens when Williams first appeared on Happy Days, and I didn't follow television that closely, but, you know, he made a stir, and, you know... He's not that, you know, he wasn't that much older than myself. He's 63. I just turned 55. So we're close to being age peers, but that's tough too.
Sure.
You know, when that happens. But for a lot of the younger critics, you know, he's a guy who was always around and who was always, you know, trying to make them smile, make them laugh. You know, there was a real basic core of humanity and truth seeking in everything Williams did, I think, even the most... surreal flights of comic fancy. He was always trying to put across an essential human, if not political, truth, and that was, I think, a function of his empathy and the things that he struggled with himself. That he, you know, eventually kind of overwhelmed him, I suppose. Looking at his work in a movie like Awakenings, that's kind of the first picture in which he plays a kind of authority figure. An authority figure, a competent authority figure, playing a doctor, which he would go back to playing on several, many occasions, sometimes in comic roles, as in the obstetrician in 9 months, or, you know, sometimes in something like Patch Adams, which, you know, people talk about as being a kind of a lesser Williams vehicle. But
working
with De Niro as Malcolm Sayer in Awakenings, you know, that's it's a doubly significant point in his career, because it's the beginning of his playing that kind of role, and also the first time he went up against someone who was such an established acting monument.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about The World According to Garp, which was a terrific movie and I think a real breakthrough for him, But he was also in a cast there that was also people who were up and comers who also went on to amazing things.
John Lithgow,
Glenn Close,
right. Sure.
All sorts of people like that. But De Niro, Amanda Plummer. Going up to De Niro was almost like going into the ring with Muhammad Ali.
Especially because De Niro hadn't lost any of his currency. We can get to what I mean by that, the late 80s, early 90s.
He was still the man.
Absolutely, the top fellas.
And beyond that, he would become a movie star. I mean, he was the guy.
This is an interesting story. I want to get to that. I just want to close on Williams, though. He also played a doctor in Good Will Hunting, I believe, right? Because he was a
good role in a good movie.
Yeah,
people have a really weird, ambivalent relationship sometimes with movies that move them, with movies that make them cry. You know, and Good Will Hunting is a real tearjerker. And I remember the other day when the announcement that Williams had died came over all of the media, and a lot of people are sort of like, "Well, I hate to admit it, but I really like Good Will Hunting." And I'm like, what? "I'm thinking, well,
at the time
you know,
we didn't.
Why apologize. Should you hate to admit it? It was, you know, it was a well received, well liked, honest movie by an honest filmmaker." You know, people like to joke about the fortuitousness of the screenplay in terms of the careers of Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, but come on, it's a good movie.
And not only that, but it seemed that Robin Williams really did rise to the occasion.
Specifically in roles where in films like that where
it was just skirting sentimentality. It's when he went over is when
he didn't get cute in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and Patch
way.
Adams. Right. That's a different story. But Patch Adams
playing to the cancer
probably
kids.
Called for cute. Yeah. You know, right. I mean, or you know, I say anyway. This to a lot of people. You never know. You know, there are very few directors. There are very few filmmakers who can actually go in with the assurance that the film that they see in their heads is going to be the film that they make.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the deal was with Patch Adams, but maybe the film that came out was not necessarily the film that was in everybody's heads.
Yeah, I think the one that where he went back into save his wife from the hereafter might have been that one.
What dreams may come. Yeah.
But anyway, I don't want to harp. But it was still a stellar career, almost unmatched by any other actor in terms of keeping that level of you know, just of taken seriously and pretty much well
loved. You
know,
at the height of his career, he was a very very busy man. He was a hard person to keep up with. He was on stage.
Right.
He was doing stand up. Is a guy who, you know, the number of times he just dropped into a club and did a 90-minute set is a filmography in and of itself.
Comic just, relief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Insane.
Thanks for humoring me, so to speak, on that, because I definitely was also on that cusp. I'm a couple of years younger than you, but, you know, he was also there pretty much through my entire adulthood, too. But this book that you wrote on De Niro, speaking of awakenings, is called Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, and it's part of a series as you've talked about. You want to mention that series? And
yeah, it's a series from Phaedon / Cahiers du Cinéma. I am not 100% certain of how it breaks down from country to country. You know, the Cahiers du Cinéma imprint as it exists as a book imprint in France. And then in the United States, it's an imprint of Phaedon, a larger publisher that does big format books for the most part. Yeah, I met with an editor from France a couple of years ago, and we kicked around some ideas. I was recommended to her by the critic and filmmaker Nicolas Sada, who I owe a thanks to. You know, box of cigars if I ever meet him in person. We kicked around a couple of ideas. I had ideas for specific standalone things. But they're very keen on these formatted books that are part of series. You know, it's what modern print publishing is about now. It has a lot to do with branding and franchises and so on. So there's nothing wrong with it. So they wanted they were launching this Anatomy of an Actor series, and Karina Longworth had done one, and there was one on Pacino, there was one on Brando. Subsequently, there's been Streep, Meryl Streep, Jack Nicholson. Amy Nicholson has written a book on Tom Cruise that was released concurrently with my own book on De Niro. After kicking around some ideas with this editor, Valerie, I came up with a list of films. They explained the format to me, and I submitted a list of films, and we didn't speak for a little while, and then I got the word, yeah, go ahead, take this take this selection of films and construct your anatomy of De Niro around that, with, you know, 10 sidebars where you'll treat other aspects of his career. And it came together relatively quickly. You know, I didn't hear from them for a while, and then I heard from them, and then, you know, after hearing from them, and the deadline was pretty tight. And then during the editing process, there was a lot of cutting going on, because as we both know, and as probably most of the people listening know, De Niro's output has been prodigious in recent years. You know, 3-4 films coming out every year. And, you know, we need a relatively up-to-date filmography. And around September of last year, you know, you have announcements, The Bagman, The Big Wedding, this, that, and the other thing. And you have to add all those films to your filmography, which means I have to cut from my actual, written matter. So the book ended up being a little tighter than I had anticipated because of De Niro's output, which is just something that happens. But it was a little funny. I was actually shown a De Niro film by one of the companies that was releasing it. I was shown, given a sort of early critics toe dip screening, and I said to them, I said, you know, this movie's unreleasable. Because I thought so, but also because I thought, well, if they don't put it out, I won't have to put it in the filmography.
Yeah, so, I see.
I won't mention the film, but it was put out, and it actually got better reviews than I anticipated. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just kind of god-awful.
Mm-hmm. Well, anybody's guess, I guess. Yeah. You know. I mean, there's been an unevenness there, but
I'll give you a hint. From the director of Lucy. How's that?
Okay. That narrows it down some.
Yeah.
Did you grapple at all? I mean, because, right, you were, had some either, it sounds like you might have had some other suggestions maybe initially, or you were bouncing ideas.
My dream book as a film writer is a biography of the director Richard Quine. I don't think to do that, or at least I don't think I'll ever get to do that unless I somehow acquire an independent income sometime between now and, you know, when I die. They were not unsympathetic to that idea, but they were just not going to, you know, back it. So I didn't do much. Once they mentioned the Anatomy series and they mentioned De Niro, there was not much grappling involved. You know, the idea of these books is to look at the entirety of an actor's career through the prism of 10 specific films, starting at the beginning of the actor's career and then ending somewhat as close to now as one can.
And those 10 are fairly arbitrary in terms of what you choose them, in the sense that they don't have to be the biggest box office successes or the most what have you. It's just,
I wouldn't say arbitrary, but they're subjective because, you know, you're kind of picking out these things that are that are ostensibly milestones. And there's a certain point in De Niro's career where the milestones are incredibly obvious. You know, Mean Streets, obvious milestone. You know, almost all the films with Scorsese up until King of Comedy, with the possible exception of New York, New York, are all milestone films. Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, King of Comedy. There's New York, New York is in there. New York, New York's a pretty good film, not quite as fully realized as those other four, so that's the one that can come out. Now, I could have just started with Mean Streets, but I didn't want to kick off with Scorsese, and as a matter of fact, the film that did get De Niro really a lot of notice from critics was Bang the Drum Slowly.
Yeah.
And it's a very, not very much like the De Niro we think we know kind of role also.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get in a little variety there. So having Bang the Drum Slowly and those four films, and then you have in there slotted in between Mean Streets and Taxi Driver, the very significant Godfather Part II, where he's not only, learning to speak Sicilian dialect, but also playing a character that was made famous by Marlon Brando. You know, talk about a kind of a symbolic or semiotic passing or grabbing of the torch, you know. So, again, that's one that you kind of have to have. So after King of Comedy, though, it becomes a little more open to suggestion, or, you know, you have to the filmography gets more expansive. It's not as teeming with masterpieces as it was. As I point out in my introduction, even by 1995, Gilbert Adair, who was a brilliant critic, a trifle on the curmudgeonly side. Even by 1995, which some people would say is still, you know, a golden age for De Niro, Gilbert Adair was saying that, you know, De Niro's performing vocabulary had degenerated into a bunch of, you know, tics and mannerisms. I don't agree with that, but I do bring it up in the introduction because it ties in with the way that De Niro was mythologized right. during the early years, especially after the achievement of Raging Bull, where he literally, you know, distorted himself physically in order to play the role of Jake LaMotta. But after King of Comedy, there's a definite shift, and it has to do with a lot of factions that have nothing to do with art, per se, or acting, but have to do with Hollywood.
And commerce.
And that's yeah. commerce. And, yeah. you know, it does play into the thing that Harry Alfland, who had been De Niro's agent, said something about, you know, De Niro will never be a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, he's just got too much integrity. That was, you know, the short version of that. But then Alfland is no longer De Niro's agent. The whole environment of Hollywood filmmaking that was described by Peter Biskind in his book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls is no longer in play. And we're now in the age of the super agents, the super agency. De Niro signs with CAA, and then Midnight Run happens. And Midnight Run, which is a film that a lot of people have a lot of affection for, and I think I underestimated it to a certain extent, because when I was writing the chapter on Midnight Run and looking at it again, I felt it, you know, I was actually a little shocked because I thought it had aged pretty badly. But people still have an enormous amount of affection for that film.
I watched it a few months back again to see again, because I hadn't watched it straight through since it originally came out either, and I was trying to figure it out. And it was more of the novelty of it. I it's interesting because you're right about that film. It was a novelty at the time for people who were used to De Niro that was humorless. I mean, not to say there wasn't a lot of great comedy in, of course, we know, but it was very dark, very weighted. And then all of a sudden he did something on the other side of the spectrum. It was very light comparatively. And he was also around that time, exactly how you describe it, where his persona was changing too. Where he went from hardly speaking in public and having that kind of reputation to all of a sudden doing like stints on Saturday Night Live all of a sudden with Pesci and kind of coming out and making fun of his persona. You know, like he's in on the joke now.
Yeah.
And I think actually that was also kind of what, all of a sudden we had more access to De Niro, it seemed like.
Well, these are all currents that are kind of happening parallel to each other, you know. I mean, I find the comedy of Mean Streets and Raging Bull, such as it is, I find that more funny than Midnight Run, actually.
Yes.
And, you know, I probably quote more lines in jest from Raging Bull than from Midnight Run, but that may just mean that I'm a very deeply disturbed person, you know. So what am I, in a circus here? So, but, you know, Midnight Run, yeah, definitely marks a beginning of a different approach to public life for De Niro. And that is accelerated in Awakenings, which is about, a couple of years later. And Awakenings, as I think I mentioned in the chapter, it's interesting because part of the deal he constructed for making that movie was that the film have its production offices in a building that he just bought, a building that is, I think, now where the Tribeca Grill is.
Right.
When he became an entrepreneur, you know, he began to tie his movie work and so on with his other business interests, you know. And you expect guys who are as sensitive in the performing realm as De Niro, I think there's something about the public perception of De Niro that expects him to channel his extracurricular activities into something more artistic. You know, you think De Niro, oh, well, he's going to found a theater company or, you know, start an acting school. But instead, he starts buying buildings. He starts getting into real estate. He starts backing restaurateurs. But this is what interests him. This is, you know, his son is a real estate agent, his son with Diane Abbott. This is his outside interest. And he pursues that. And it's part of, you know, one of the reasons he does as many films as he does is he gets the revenue from his acting is channeled back into his business interests, which also include, with the Tribeca Film Festival and so on, trying to do things and working with charities and so on, trying to put money back into a neighborhood that was very, very much affected by the attacks of 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What do you get a sense after having thought about it, I guess, at length. What if there was a transition in De Niro as well? I mean, it's almost beside the point, I guess, but I'm just wondering if there was some sort of, there was a turnout, or if this was always sort of in there and, you know, like this other side to him and, you know, where he wasn't, he was never going to keep that mystique side to him so much.
Well, he's just, you know, the period he worked with Scorsese, both of those artists were, you know, at that peak, they were very consumed. They were pursuing things with this incredible, fierce intensity. An intensity that, you know, as Scorsese has pointed out more than once, can be very destructive, or at least self-destructive. And I think both of them, you know, we don't hear much about... De Niro is not necessarily prone to addictions or anything like that. You know,
right.
Scorsese's been pretty frank about having, you know, done a lot of damage to himself physically through substance abuse. At the period, you know, during the late 70s, early 80s, you know, you don't hear about that about De Niro. But De Niro, I think, especially after, it's funny because you see Raging Bull, and Scorsese has spoken a lot about how he thought Raging Bull might be the last film he would ever make. De Niro, too, gains 40 pounds for the role. It had to be an exhausting process. And you'd think that after going through that exhausting process that the two artists had expiated a certain amount of whatever it is that was bugging them, you know. But then they make King of Comedy, which is a film that is absolutely suffused with negative emotions.
Yes.
But it's a different kind of film. It's a little more cerebral. It's a little more mordant. It's a bitter film. There's no getting around it. And then they stop working together. And I think they both have not necessarily a self-conscious or conscious thing, but they do a reboot on their careers, respectively.
Well, they did Casino, right?
They did. The first film they did after about 8 years of not working together was Goodfellas.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that was a film that De Niro helped Martin Scorsese get made, because it was his name on the contracts that got the last round of financing done. So it became, the collaboration took on a different kind of nature. It was no longer, as much as their personal relationship would be of equals and guys who knew each other and knew of each other even before they worked together, their relationship now, or a relationship from Goodfellas on, was of two, autonomous artists helping each other out. You know, De Niro signed up for Goodfellas. Scorsese took on Cape Fear, which is not, I think is probably my least favorite Scorsese movie, and not a movie he did with a gun to his head, but not also a movie that was of his conception. You know, it was developed through Steven Spielberg's production company, and De Niro was signed on for the role, and Scorsese came on. Casino was, De Niro helping out Scorsese. And they haven't worked together since Casino. So, and I think that they're, you know, they would like to. They're looking for the right project, but their careers are very, very different now.
Yeah.
You know, Scorsese is very firmly entrenched in a movie making mode that is big ticket and big budget. This is why he's had to wait so long to get a quieter project like Silence off the ground, but he'll hopefully be shooting that within a month or so from when we're speaking. And De Niro, who said even as, around the time of This Boy's Life, that he doesn't want to work as hard at what he does as he used to. In his early days in acting, he was very passionate about earning the right to a particular role, to the extent of, driving a cab, to research Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. He said, This Boy's Life, which is a terrific performance and a good picture, but he said, I don't do that kind of intensive research anymore. He's relaxed a bit into being a working actor and also feeling like he likes to work. And he said, he had a bout with prostate cancer in around 2004 and recovered, but that is sort of increased his urgency with respect to the idea that he just keeps working. Yeah. You know?
But you didn't include This Boy's Life is not in the
it's not in the book.
That, I just wanted to point mentioned. That out. And nor is Deer Hunter, but I know you struggled with that.
Yeah,
one,
I mean, Deer Hunter was a tough call.
It's more of an ensemble.
And eventually
film
it
too.
Just sort of came down to my personal preference. Right. I mean, yeah. To be completely honest, I felt I had more to say about, say, King of Comedy or Raging Bull than I did about Deer Hunter.
Right.
It's a personal connection. But the last four after those six that I mentioned are, Midnight Run, Awakenings, Meet the Parents, and Stone. And Meet the Parents represents another career milestone or shift where, going back to what you mentioned, the idea of playing with or playing off of the familiar De Niro persona.
Which he also did with the Analyze movies. But
yeah, the Analyze movies, very much rent. So. Yeah, I mean, the Analyze movies aren't talked about much. They were pretty entertaining at the time, but, David Chase sort of picked up the idea of a mafia guy talking to a shrink and ran with it, and it's kind of subsumed the Analyze movies. But, Meet the Parents, to me, was... also because of the way that Meet the Parents spawned this kind of quasi-franchise where you get these iconic actors from the era in which De Niro came up or peripheral to the era in which De Niro came up, just sort of spoofing themselves or spoofing their personas with, Meet the Fockers. You have Dustin Hoffman and Barbara Streisand joining in on the quote-unquote fun.
And also blatantly trying to corner demographics, like not even trying to mask that, which is almost kind of an honest way of saying, we're going for that irony of we're all getting together. You remember all of us.
Yeah, sure. Well, this all goes back.
I mean, that was also why that De Niro Pacino did a couple of movies.
Yeah, the problem for working actors of a certain age is a film culture that's constantly catering to younger audiences. And I remember before Jack Nicholson did The Joker and Tim Burton's Batman, there was a profile of Nicholson in the New York Times Magazine where he's talking about how he went to see Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and he came out and he was terrified because he thought, what's there for me?
Yeah.
And he figured out what was there for him was that kind of version of himself that was teetering, if not completely committing to a kind of self-parody. And it reestablished him as a star and, reestablished him as a name your price kind of star. So he kind of had the last laugh, but...
thank God for Nora.
And he was able to have the last laugh without really creating a career that people are usually disappointed in, which is not true of De Niro. People like to complain about their disappointment with De Niro.
Yeah, yeah.
He's sort of squandering.
But I do kind of think Nicholson did too. But I understand it. You give a context.
There aren't
to,
as many.
You give a context to it because, when you go back to Five Easy Pieces, hey, there's another. There's your next book. Well, no, you said Jack Nicholson's already been done. Who did that one, by the way?
I don't recall who.
They can hawk their own books.
Yeah.
We're going to talk. That's okay. That's great. So,
putting my teeth here.
Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, is currently on sale where most books are sold.
It is indeed.
and I covet it. Now you have your blog, Some Came Running.
Yeah, I don't get to post as much to that as I would like.
Well, every time a celebrity dies.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There you go.
Good grief.
I know. And then you're also a contributor to, I don't know how many
I write film
places.
Reviews for RogerEbert.com.
Right.
I do short features for VanityFair.com. I contribute to Current, the Criterion Collection blog, which is a really fun thing to do.
That's got to be a good gig.
And other things. You know, it's difficult out there to be a working film critic. Outlets are... There aren't that
it's
many.
Not an oxymoron.
There are quite a few outlets, but there aren't that many that that can pay you enough that you can actually make a living at it. So it's a... I like De Niro at the point of Midnight Run. I'm at a career crossroads.
I see. there's teaching.
No, well, I don't. I've applied for a teaching job more than once, and maybe I'll get one. I mean, we'll see. I doubt that whatever happens, it's doubtful that I'll entirely disappear from the film critic landscape. But I may just you know, do other, you know, Philip Lopate has talked about how for, you know, for a long time film critic was an avocation and not a vocation. So it may turn that and turn into that for me. The problem is finding another vocation.
Sure.
You know, I used to joke with my old one of my old bosses at Premiere. I had been an editor at Premiere before I took the position of film critic, and actually, you know, once I became the film critic, yes, that became my professional identity, and that's actually I wouldn't call it an active liability, but it certainly gets you pigeonholed, and people don't, you know, well, I'm an editor too, and I do so and so and da 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 da.
Right, but
and they're like, but you're a film critic, you're a film guy. I like that phrase. You're a film guy.
A film guy.
I'm a film guy, man. I'm going to put that on my business card. Filmguy.com.
What about doing more books? I mean, I'm not, again, that's
books,
not necessarily.
Books are terrific, you know. But we are not going to, you know, books are great to do. We don't have to go into the economics of them. But
right, no, I understand.
They're not, you know, I don't want to complain. It's just, you know, it's tough for a lot of people to make a living. So, you know, I'm just, it's a weird thing to be at a certain point in your life and still kind of be functioning on a month-by-month basis.
I understand.
I guess maybe it gives your writing an edge.
As you said before, you'll gladly...
We'll blog for food, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm very... It really was giving me an all-new perspective in terms of De Niro and his career. It's a really... thoughtful approach to an amazing actor, and what was also, I don't want this to get missed because of all the movie titles that have come up in the conversation, but when we look at some of those clips and we look at them with fresh eyes, and we can go back and realize just how he changed the game for. You know,
there's a lot of variety in what he's doing, even if he's kind of narrow casting it. He is very, you know, when we did the event at Videology, I began with a clip from Goodfellas, which I don't treat at length in the book, but only because I wanted to, as this scene in which Sunshine of Your Love is playing, and his character, Jimmy Conway, is contemplating murdering the poor fellow played by Chuck Lowe, and he's standing at the bar smoking a cigarette, and it's one of those Scorsese dolly in camera moves with a little bit of variation in the frame rate. It speeds up, it slows down, and De Niro's, just the way he tilts his head, just the way he looks over to the right, looks over to the left, takes a draw on the cigarette, and there's a precision to the choreography, the way he's working in tandem with what Scorsese's doing with the camera, and it's just spectacularly precise screen acting, and that's, you know, that's the skill, that's the craft, that's amazing, and there's no one else who can do what he does. And you know, I interviewed Edward Norton for the
Stone,
for the book, for the last film in the series, Stone, which is a really spectacular De Niro performance and a really interesting film that just sort of got buried in distribution. And Edward was talking about Robert De Niro working with the director, John Curran. And, you know, so yeah, John was excited to work with De Niro, but John is not a director who kind of is like hugely accommodating or coddles anybody, especially regardless of reputation. He directs. He's a director. And he says, and I think what De Niro wants, what De Niro responds to, is a director who will direct. I think a lot of the work he does now and a lot of the parts he's taking now, the parts aren't as demanding. The directors are probably the more likely to just sit back and say, you know, you do your thing. You do your De Niro thing. That didn't happen on Stone, and as a result, you got a performance that was focused and concentrated and really something to see.
You know, a lot of people have said that about... I didn't personally see it, but I did see Stone when it came out, at least on DVD or what have you, when it was out digitally, and remember liking it a great deal, but I had forgotten about it till your book, and when I saw the clip in your you know, multimedia presentation the other night, I was able to, you know, really say, yes, I agree with you. I think that is a much stronger film than A Silver Linings Playbook. I just think it was too cute again, that movie.
Yeah, no, Silver Linings Playbook is a good performance in a film that I think was off the mark, let's just say. You know, and he's good also, De Niro's good in American Hustle. I mean, he's called upon to be incredibly menacing. He actually kind of like, just as the film is, I think, kind of just diminishes in my estimation every time I think of it. It's just so cutesy.
Yeah.
But when De Niro shows up, he's actually quite convincingly menacing. When he's gone, you miss him.
Yeah, and you know, I just have a hard time when I feel like marketing departments and publicists have the upper hand with the movie, and we were all, you know, and David O. Russell has made some very good films too, but it's, you know, where we're kind of told ahead of time, this is already, you know, a masterpiece, this is already, before anybody's seen it, and I'm not a sucker.
I don't blame David O. Russell for positioning himself in a place where he can continue to, like, get films produced and actually get them distributed, given all the nonsense that he's had to put up with in his career since I Heart Huckabees. But he is definitely not the director who made I Heart Huckabees anymore either, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
It's a matter of survival for him, I think, to trot out this... I'm American cinema's new populist humanist dude. So, you know, whatever works, I guess.
Well, Glenn Kenny, film critic, the film, not just a film guy, film critic and author and cineast, I guess. I don't know. Right. So thanks for kindly. And you live in Brooklyn, right? You're married?
I live in Brooklyn with my wife in Carroll Gardens, where I've lived for 25 years. And
wow, even around the time I was living there, maybe.
Yeah, no. Hope to continue living there for a bit.
A bit longer. I hope so, too.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Come back on, please. Decay is it will be in select theaters on demand and on iTunes all on this Friday, August 22nd, and it's an entertaining, very entertaining, funny documentary about the actor George Takei. So here is my conversation, and it was on the Queen Mary too. I interviewed Jennifer in a dining room aboard the Queen Mary too. So if you hear some background noise, it's just because we weren't the only ones, and I did not stay on the ship. So just FYI, I didn't go on the cruise, unfortunately. But it was a Cunard, and it seemed like very fancy, very very fun. So I considered stowing away, but at the last minute I ditched. Here's my conversation with the lovely Jennifer Kroot.
Oh my.
Hello out there. I'm Mr. Sulu of Star Trek.
As far as I can remember, I've always been me.
I have to tell you that in my email, no one gets more positives than George.
I totally love your smart humor on Facebook.
I was the best helmsman in the galaxy. And put to rest all that stereotype about Asian drivers.
Aye, aye, sir. Warp 3.
No, this is... have you been on a cruise before, Jennifer Kroot?
No, I have not.
You haven't gone on a... No?
No.
After all that champagne... Cheers. After all that champagne...
Did you have some champagne?
I did. And I knew when to cut myself off, because with champagne, it just goes down so smooth.
Yeah.
But we're on
That's
the...
That's why I didn't start.
No, wise. We're on the Queen Mary 2?
That's it.
Wow. I did a cruise many years ago. Not... I mean, relatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You enjoyed it?
I did. It wasn't quite as swanky as the Queen Mary, but it wasn't a Cunard.
And no one got norovirus? There was no quarantining
no.
of the ship?
No. Yeah. But I did get sick the first night.
Oh, just and the first night.
Yeah. No, I was sick for the first 2 days of the cruise. I don't know what happened. I got a bug or something. But then I got fortunately better and was able to enjoy the five days. But it's kind of fun as an experiment, so, you know. But unfortunately, we have to disembark.
Yeah, no, I didn't bring enough stuff. So, It's probably for the
best.
But
if you're going to break the law in Stowaway, you can break the law and steal people's, like, Bermuda shorts.
And you're keeping track of time, right?
Yes, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, sure, of course. Right, what time do you want to make sure?
What time did we start? I didn't even
look. Oh, no, just, well, the film started, let's be conservative, and we'll say it started 15 minutes ago.
Okay.
Even though I think it was a little less
than
that.
I think it was...
And how many minutes are we talking about?
It's 93 minutes.
93 minutes?
And I'd love to,
Okay, so, this is going to be, you're going
to
be done way before that.
Oh, I know,
that.
I just wanted
we'll
to
do this for about 20, 25 minutes or something. Unless we just start getting mesmerized.
Yeah.
Jennifer Crute, the film is called To Be Decay.
That's right.
And it's a portrait.
Documentary
portrait of the actor and activist, George Takei.
That's right.
Who we know through, of course, Star Trek fame, but who actually has quite a bit more of a backstory than most people are aware.
That's true. He was imprisoned as a child in a Japanese-American internment camp.
Okay.
Along with 120,000 other Japanese-Americans at that time.
Unbelievable.
Faced quite a big obstacle early on in his life that definitely stuck with him, and something that I'm sure he reflects on every day even now, and has made him become a civil rights activist more so in the past for Asian American issues like the redress, for instance, and then more recently in 2005 he came out as a gay man and then publicly married his longtime partner, now husband, Brad, and so that was another obstacle that he had faced as a closeted actor in Hollywood.
Right. Yeah, and that's a big portion of the film, too, is their relationship.
Yes.
We follow them through a period of time. And, and it's also during a period of time where gay marriage is an enormous topic as well. So
yes. Yeah, it is now as well.
Exactly.
So, their relationship ends up being kind of one of the present-day threads, as well as we give a little history about their relationship. But they have a very comfortable dynamic that I think people who've been in or are in long-term relationships will recognize.
And relate to, Tell me a little bit about yourself, though, because I know you have some work. I haven't seen your earlier film, but we emailed about it. But But tell me about, like, a little bit of the backstory of your becoming a documentary filmmaker and also, you know, choosing this particular... We're being joined by George here.
Yeah.
No.
So I made a film prior to this called It Came from Kuchar. Mm-hmm. I guess I wouldn't say I made a choice to be a documentary filmmaker. I made a narrative feature.
It's
a little more... underground, kind of. I went to art school.
Where'd you go?
I went to San Francisco Art Institute.
Okay.
And studied with George Kuchar, which is how I met George Kuchar. And
For those who don't know who he is,
yes, George Kuchar was an underground filmmaker who has a twin brother named Mike Kuchar. George is now deceased, sadly, for those of us who knew him. And his brother Mike thrives in San Francisco still. They were known as the Kuchar brothers in the 60s, and they worked in the Warhol underground film scene of that time. And only their films were much funnier than Warhol's films and many of the underground films. And not as slow-paced, more parodies of melodramas that they were obsessed with as children growing up in the Bronx, and sort of deconstructing, non-purposely.
Like Douglas Sirk type of films?
They were obsessed with Douglas Sirk that whole thing.
Right.
And I think loved the fantasy of going to see those types of movies about dramatic adults, I think they would say, with sordid lives and lurid details, and then they would dress up their friends in their neighborhood and get on the roof and act out similar films and in a just very honest way, as if they were trying to climb back into those films. But their movies had more details of real life, sometimes even including bathroom shots, which was actually where John Waters got the idea to start working with feces.
Because
he was a fan of theirs.
So they were scatological.
George was more scatological than Mike. Mike is much more into, Greek and Roman classics. And then George's brings the...
but there is an element of homoerotica in there, too?
Yes, without... Yeah, oh, definitely. Some people could miss it if you weren't
really
tuned into it, but other people find it very obvious.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
So, anyway, I became fascinated with George because he was my teacher, and I actually hadn't seen his earlier films. I'd seen... He later sort of paved the way for video diaries. I think he was one of the early pioneers of sort of these video diaries. But he would put, like, very theatrical music with them. But it was just stuff he was doing on a day-to-day basis or going to events and stuff. But very entertaining. And he was... I saw a lot of those. And just his personality was extremely unique. And his Bronx accent. And just a larger-than-life individual for people who didn't know him. But anyway, so I just wanted to make a film about George, which led me into making a documentary. And now I made another documentary. So I think of myself as more of a filmmaker. Documentaries, I do like documentaries a lot, though.
George Takei. Well, it's kind of it's so particular, and, you know, you're obviously much younger generation, and you don't seem to be a Trekkie.
A Trekkie.
You are a Trekkie.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, closeted, or I don't know, seemingly closeted, I guess, as a Trekkie.
Maybe so.
Yeah, I don't know why people never think I'm a Trekkie. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
So okay. So did you grew up watching Star Trek?
Yeah, I mean, in reruns, I grew up watching the original Star Trek, and yeah, I love the original Star Trek, and I still do. It's different when I watch it now. Mm-hmm. But because now I know all these things about it.
Of course. Well, now you're so deep inside of that.
Lost my sci-fi innocence.
How close did you guys get, you and George, during the course of making this film?
Is he
a warm, congenial guy, or is he like careful in that way, cautious, emotionally?
I would say he's pretty warm. I mean, you know, he's not the kind of person that I'm trying to think. I mean... Not thinking that... Yeah, he's a pretty warm guy, and he's very present with people. He listens very well.
Does he?
Likes to advise, like, in a warm way, in sort of a professorial but warm way.
Right. But that's his comfortable mode.
It's a comfortable mode for him.
Guidance,
I mean, I know him pretty well. We stayed with them once for 5 days, like, where we were all in the same house, so... We had breakfast together. We did all those things and went to the grocery store together, you know.
That was the longest stretch?
Well, that was when we'd never stayed at their house otherwise. We were in Arizona with them.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was a lot of time together. So I think sort of, become just sort of extended family. I mean, I think he does end up becoming friends with a lot of people he works on different types of projects with because they're all doing... things together.
Yeah, this is different than the average talk. Exactly. It's an intimate type of situation. And navigating that relationship between filmmaker and subject when you really do want to kind of expose the nuances of that person. And, you know, the closer you can get, let's face it, the more fascinating an experience it is for people when they're watching the film, right? So, you know, to gain their trust is a big deal.
Yeah, no, we definitely spent a lot of time together, and you know, you want to gain their trust, but I also don't like to say too much to them about what I'm wanting or looking for. I want them
it unfold. Course. Right, right, of course.
Because I think sometimes, Brad would be like, "Well, I don't know what you're going for here. I don't know what you," and it's like, I just stay quiet.
Right. Exactly. You're just go about what you do, and I'm here to shoot that, and you know, hopefully something emerges from that. We're not telling you how to craft
live your life.
So
end up spending a lot of time together. So I definitely feel very familiar when I see them, and then thinking, I'm not sure when I'll see them next because now they're going off on their trip, and then you know, just trying to not sure what the next.
Did you ever? It sounds like maybe were you kind of there were times where you weren't sure how much they were collaborating in this, and how much maybe they just sort of expected you to figure that out.
I'm trying to think.
Do you feel like they were collaborators? In other words,
well, they're definitely collaborators in the sense like Brad would let me know like what types of events they had coming up because there were I wanted to film. A science fiction convention.
Sure.
I wanted to film some of his civil rights speeches. I wanted to film, him possibly doing a pilgrimage to one of the internment camps that he'd been imprisoned in. And so Brad would let me know. I mean, they have a really busy schedule, and so he'd let me know when different things were coming up that he was doing. Mm-hmm. And so then I would plan with him. And so he was in on, like, what we were filming, but he didn't know, you know, what would get included or not. And I remember him saying, oh, I remember early on, oh, these civil rights speeches could be kind of boring, too. I mean, to shoot. So, but, you know, I think he just was thinking, because it just looks like a speech, and there's usually like a ficus in the background or something, right. You know. It's not like, maybe not even a real one.
I understood.
So, you know, that it's not super cinematic looking.
Were you comfortable kind of saying, don't worry about it, this is, I got that covered, you just go back and do thing,
I mean,
and we'll worry about that in the edit, you know.
Yeah, no, for sure. You just say, no, I think it could be interesting, and don't overthink it, and we'll, yeah, just don't, you know. And once in a while he'd be like, but what are you going to do with this? Or, you know, I think it must be very hard if you're a subject, like, and probably more so Brad than George, because George is often in things and they get put together.
Yeah. Well, describe their dynamic, because maybe those who are listening don't understand.
Well, so
they're married.
They're married, and they've been together for close to 30 years.
Oh, my God, I didn't realize that long.
And Brad is also George's manager, and that's the role that he created, or that they created for him. So when George was a publicly closeted actor, you know, his manager would be with him a lot or be traveling with him. But it turned out that Brad's just really good with details and organizing and overseeing everything.
And right. And image, I mean, and to some degree, handling the image.
Mm-hmm.
That's,
handling
and
the
it
image.
Seems like he hasn't
the brand.
The brand.
Now the brand.
And that's what you're kind of describing in terms of Brad wants to handle the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, don't worry so much about the brand.
Right.
Because really we're trying to get beyond the brand.
Right, and they didn't have editorial control, so I could understand, like, what is she going to do with the brand, or is she going to, you know.
Yeah, but the good news is, I mean, you really did get some great moments in there. They're both entertaining and informative and moving, and, you know, it's all there. And I don't know, it seems like that the two guys, even if they were, I don't know how, you know, participating or collaborating they were, but in the end...
Yeah.
They certainly weren't the opposite of that because you got a good, really entertaining
film out
of it.
Well, they were very positive about it. I think Brad was maybe more curious, like, how is this going to be used? I don't understand what this process is. And usually it wasn't, like, a problem, but I could just see him puzzling. And then George, I think, just went with it and trusted him more.
Yeah. Well, he's obviously far more comfortable in front of the camera.
Right, with the camera.
And been his brand.
And
we call
been,
it
he
so long,
yeah.
And he's been that so many years that he figures you're gonna want it or you're not, you're gonna buy into it or you're not. Yeah, exactly. So,
Did you see the film?
Somebody provided me a link, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't remember. Maybe it wasn't you. Maybe it was you. You didn't provide it, right?
I don't think I did. I think you had already seen it. When
okay.
Approached me.
Oh, yes, you're right. I'm trying to think of where it played. Well, let's talk about that. You premiered at Sundance, was
That's
it?
Right.
Yeah. Well, talk about that, because so many people that listen to this are saying, well, how does that happen?
Oh,
I mean, that's an
a
blue chip, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, we hoped. We applied as late as you can apply, and, you know, it turned out that a number of programmers really loved the film, we found out later, and really championed it through the journey of all the rounds. So, you know, you hope for the best and expect the worst, and you just have your eyes set on the next festival.
You had no confidence that you were submitting...
I'm not as positive as George is, so... No, I had
But this is your work, not George's.
Oh, yeah, but I mean just as far as the... just in general, like not... I'm just not as positive a person as George is. So, although I think I've learned a little bit about that since being around him so much. But no, I just don't like to get my hopes up for things. I just disappointed.
Where'd you grow up, Jennifer Crute?
I grew up in the Bay Area, so Marin County mostly. I was born in Berkeley and then grew up in Marin County.
What did your parents do?
What did they do?
Mm-hmm. Or what did they do?
My dad is an architect. He's still an architect, really amazing architect.
Mm-hmm.
Bay Area architect.
Okay. And your mom raised the family?
Mom is mostly a mom, but also sort of does some part-time work with my dad, is the Brad of the family, I guess you'd say.
Gotcha.
So she does organizing and bookkeeping.
He's really involved.
My dad's a very busy architect, and my mom...
Industrial
keeps
type
everything.
Of architecture?
He mostly does homes.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Residential.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
In Marin, a little bit in San Francisco,
right.
In the East Bay.
And where'd you end up going to? Did you go to film school or did you go to?
I did. I dabbled in film school. I went to the San Francisco Art Institute, is where I ended up after going to San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm.
Huge.
Well, I mean, I've heard of it.
Oh, it's it's a small art school in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a fine arts college. And
okay.
Yeah, it's where George Cuchar taught for many years.
Right.
That was sort of my draw. So it's, has been more experimental in the past. Yeah.
Did you have influences or?
Yeah.
Other than obviously the Cuchars.
The Cuchars I heard about later. But earlier influences... Well, love Jean Cocteau. Loved.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. You'd immediately think that after watching To Be Decay.
I know. It's great films. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Loved David Lynch, early David Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
Was obsessed with Blue Velvet at the time.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. And I loved that movie, Repo Man.
Mm-hmm.
My
so,
youth.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely like kind
Sid
of underground.
Nancy.
Really? So,
yeah.
Yeah, early independent.
That kind of 80s independent were my first influences.
You must have been very young.
Yeah, I was pretty young, but I was younger then.
We're
on that conveyor belt towards death now, but yeah.
Yes.
See my negativity. So let's see. And then as far as documentaries, Paris is Burning is probably my favorite. I mean, if I had to pick a favorite, there's lots of great documentaries, but... Love Paris is Burning, love Crumb.
Well, that's a great one, yeah.
Crumb was actually a colleague of George Cuchar, because George Cuchar was also a comic artist for Arcade.
Okay.
In that time of comics in San Francisco, jumping around here. Let's see. Capturing the Freedmans, love that.
Classics.
Yeah.
Tell me, when you finally... who was your editor on the film again? Please
Bill Weber.
Bill Weber.
Yeah, he's editor and has a co-director credit as well.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Yeah. So really
we'll
helpful. Really thoughtful in putting complex stories together.
You did a fabulous job. It's
Thank
really
you.
Well edited. And hopefully Bill, maybe at some point, Bill Weber will come on the show.
My father told me, look at the kind of roles that Asians are playing. And I said, Daddy, I'm going to change it.
There weren't many Asians on television, so when George would come on, it would be a special thing.
And he was kind of a sex symbol.
In order for me to have a viable career, I was closeted.
I can't imagine what it would be like to have to hide that identity.
We're a good fit because Brad is detail-oriented, but he sometimes gets a little overwhelmed.
This is
it's
our
all right.
This is our house.
It's
We're not filming in front of our house.
He gets so nervous.
My life has been transformed as fantastically as science fiction. As a boy, I looked out on the world, imprisoned behind the barbed wire fences of American internment camps. It was a painful moment there. I don't believe in negativity. You determine your destiny.
What was that experience like showing it to George and Brad? What was that like?
Well, we didn't show them the finished product until our premiere at Sundance.
Oh, smart, though.
We had a... Yes, smart and terrifying.
Yeah, no doubt.
So
right.
We had shown them a rough cut at a private screening with the group in San Francisco a few months before that, but it wasn't totally set, but we just wanted to see if there was anything that really rubbed them the wrong way.
Right.
And, nothing did.
What if it had, though?
Well, then we would have had to make some tough decisions about
sure.
that. So we would have... I mean, I know there are things like the Jerry Lewis movies that George took parts in.
Describe that part of it, since you brought it up.
Yeah, George took two roles in two different Jerry Lewis movies that are really Asian stereotypes, and that he's not proud of those roles. He had promised his father he wouldn't take any stereotypical roles. He believes, his agent really pushed him in that direction, but he also realizes it was his mistake. And I know that's something he didn't didn't and doesn't love seeing over and over again. Right, so, right.
But you have to reconcile it and own it.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's
and it was the late 50s, I guess, or something like that.
I think it might be in the 60s. I'm mm-hmm. not sure the exact
year.
Yeah,
that would have been the height of his Jerry Lewis's films, late 50s into the 60s.
Okay, yeah, maybe it was even earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, I mean, there's a moment at the end of the film when they're talking about that Brad wishes that he had practiced his lines a little more in this mm-hmm. play that he's doing. And I was a little concerned that they might be annoyed by that. Or, you know, you just don't know. Something. There's some very personal moments about their moms and, you know, their relationships with their moms. That is that too intimate? You just don't know.
Sure. But that's, of course, what we're want to...
Exactly.
We want to see that.
Yeah.
I mean, because we'll actually... And it speaks to their credit that maybe they understand that people don't go to documentaries to see some sort of, you know... Mm-hmm. Just some sort of marketing.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Gig thing going on there that you actually want to see the ups and downs and the, you know, the whole picture.
The reality,
exactly.
Yeah, captured.
You know, scars and all.
Yeah, no, and I'm really appreciative that they went with that, for sure. But, you know, you just, like I said, brace yourself for the worst.
Yeah.
That's what I usually do.
Wow. Well, you seem quite an optimistic person. I don't know. So the movie's called To Be Decay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about the life and times of actor and activist George Takei.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us discovered George in Star Trek, the TV series and the motion pictures. But there's much more to the story, as it turns out.
Yeah.
And do we know specifically that it's August 20? Did you say it was?
Yeah, so currently it's still screening exclusively on DirecTV, which was a 30-day exclusive.
Right now?
Yeah. Run.
Through what day?
You know what? It started on July 3rd, and it was 30 days. So
okay, so that's past tense. So as far as we're concerned,
right? Yeah.
As far as
so
we're concerned,
it had that.
So it had the
direct.
Yeah. No, it's okay. That's
had
what I
that
do.
Exclusivity.
So you had. So that was interesting. So that's an interesting thing. Was that was done through Starz?
Yeah. Collaboration with Starz and DirecTV.
DirecTV.
And so then the next thing that
how'd
happens
that go?
Is very well. Yeah.
So you had a 30-day
really excited
exclusive broadcast.
Or well, it's. DirecTV is like a VOD.
Oh, it's it's VOD.
Exclusive VOD. It's not later. It'll be back on normal VOD. But this
right.
Was like
I understand. Only on DirecTV, which is part of Verizon, or is it something else now?
I don't know.
DirecTV doesn't matter.
I think they're working with AT&T.
Sure. So it was on DirecTV. You did a 30-day exclusive VOD with them. Good. Okay.
And then August 22nd is when theatrical and iTunes and all of those things happen.
Day and date. And
exactly.
Then, and that is that. So you're going to have a theatrical in New York and in San mm-hmm. Francisco, I imagine.
Yeah, it's in about 25 or more cities in North America
on August 22nd.
That's right.
Oh, terrific! Yeah. And then is it going to more cities after that? I'm just asking because that's
after that. Well, then it depends on how it does. So please come see it.
Yeah. No, but starting as many cities that is also very exceptional.
Yeah, no,
for
we've
a documentary
had a
of these.
Lot of interest, so it's been great.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's been very very exciting.
Yeah. Do we owe this to, the Sundance success, to the celebrity of George?
I think a little of everything. I mean, certainly I'll say it's helpful to have a high-profile celebrity that mm-hmm. is such a beloved figure, but you have to make a great film, I would like to say. You know,
good.
We worked really hard on... Thank you. We worked really hard to make a really in-depth, intimate film about George and his husband, Brad. And then I think when... We got a number of offers at Sundance, and it was great to get in Sundance. And it really is a different festival.
Yeah,
say that.
Right. No, it's a whole different trajectory, right?
Yeah.
Once you're starting from there. Right.
I love South by Southwest. I had a film there, but and so I expected it like that. But this was a whole
that would have
different
been ideal. But
thing.
Look, Sundance. Yeah. Let's face it. Come on.
And then we got great sales agent. I mean, it's all been lined up really well.
Yeah,
and
good for you.
Yeah, and then we went with Starz because they love the film. They had a great offer, and then they came on with a great PR team. So,
do they do the theatrical?
Yeah,
distribution as well.
Yeah, it's Starz Digital Media. So they're actually it's so complicated.
Never heard that.
I know most people think of them as the broadcast station, but that they're a much much bigger company than that. So it's not even, it may actually broadcast on something else. It depends on what they do with those rights, because they have those rights.
It's a division of Starz, which is distribution, and they handle theatrical as well as digital.
I think it's
and
the
VOD.
Bigger company.
Right,
that,
I understand.
That owns the broadcast
And they own a cable stations, right. But they're
exactly.
bigger, and they're a big media company. Gotcha.
Right, exactly.
Big and probably company. Maybe regionally somewhere else there, people know that better than
maybe.
New York. Yeah, I agree.
Maybe.
Where it's like, here IFC's big. No,
that's
no,
right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Anything coming up, like now that you, I know you're still on this wave
right.
where you're seeing it through and making
literally
lots of appearances.
Right now.
Exactly, we are on a ship,
I can't feel
which
any
is
waves
a first
now.
For. I can't. Unfortunately, we're still at port, so I can't say we're in international waters. So this podcast is still being done from the States. I
the
haven't
transatlantic
done,
premiere
in my 220 some shows. I haven't done a show from abroad yet, but I'm hoping to do.
This is the first step.
It is a step. It's a step in the right direction. But it's lovely. Oh, we were going to say, do you have some ideas for a future project lined
up? Oh, I
do.
I have ideas. I don't think I'm going to share them.
Okay. You don't have to.
Yeah, but it's a documentary narrative hybrid is one of the ideas.
And all right.
It's sorted
those
tales,
are popular,
sorted no. Hollywood tales.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look more from Jennifer Crute, your
sort
lovely
of,
and,
yes,
and talented
you.
Filmmaker.
God bless. Sort of a Hollywood Babylon type of tale.
I understand. That was Kenneth Anger.
Right, but this would have nothing to do with Kenneth Anger.
No, I understand that, yeah. but you know, he was for...
He wrote that.
Even though he wrote it.
He created
and,
that.
Yeah, he created that, and it changed...
It's a great term.
Yeah, and it also created, though, well, there's much in his wake from having created that.
Yeah.
Kenneth Anger is a pioneer in that way of things tawdry and
mm-hmm.
tabloid,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever you do, I hope, you know, it make that an entertaining twist on. I'm sure you'll have an entertaining
I'll
twist.
I'll do my best.
On. Yeah. we'll like, come back on.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And talk about whatever you... You
know, for sure.
And maybe we can get George to, we'll figure out the George, maybe we can Skype or call with George.
Yeah, he doesn't Skype.
Okay.
But maybe a call.
Yeah. You know, even if it's like very, very brief, because,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
you know, let's face it, that
yeah.
would be fun to get his take on things.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But
if there was a second after, we could try to grab him, but yeah.
Might, I'm not counting on it.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
it's okay. I didn't set it up. It's not like I was expecting it, so I don't
okay.
have the,
okay.
you know. I roll.
Yeah.
I roll with
oh,
things.
That's, what it sounds
like.
That's great. I wish
yeah.
I did. Yeah,
you're lovely, and it was nice to meet you.
God bless.
And I just suspect you're not religious, but
why?
I don't know. Maybe you're saying it ironically.
Oh, no.
Sounded like
oh,
you were saying "God bless" ironically.
Well, no, I mean it, but I don't. I mean more like mysteries of the universe, bless.
Okay, more in a spiritual sense of the.
I'm from Northern California.
Yes, gotcha. Understood. All right.
With new age people.
Nice meeting you, Jennifer.
Nice
and thank
meeting you.
You. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We'll have you back on soon.
George is the love of my life. I'm proud of him.
I've heard that before.
You know, what makes him appealing is that people feel like they have a very real connection to him.
I hope he realizes what he has succeeded in doing.
It's okay to be decay.
Can you open the Fritos, please?
My.
All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening in. Coming up in the next couple of episodes, quite a few wonderful guests. Just so you know, I will be interviewing the filmmaker Tim Sutton, who has a new film called Memphis, on the life of, which is kind of like a hybrid quasi documentary, quasi narrative type of film, if you will, but it's a fiction film at the end, but it's about Willis Earl Beale and the musician, and who I believe recently opened or is currently opening for Cat Power, and follows him around this town called Memphis, it so happens, and it's a great film. You may remember Tim if you're a big indie film person. He made a movie a couple years ago called Pavilion. This is his second film, and again, it's called Memphis, and it'll be opening soon. And we're in mid-September, I believe, and we're bringing on Tim Sutton, so he'll be on. Also coming up later this week, Iris Sachs, the filmmaker, returns to Filmwax Radio. This will be Iris' second visit. His film, which is called Love is Strange, starring John Lithgow and Alfred Molina, is also opening up Friday, September 22nd, all over the place. And it will continue to open up all over the country in many, many theaters and cities and towns around the country. And so Ira will be on the show, as will Dan Schechter, who I've been mentioning for a while. I think that's next week. His film is called Life of Crime, and it's a great comedy adapted from a popular Elmore Leonard novel. Elmore Leonard, who died right before he died, gave Dan his blessings to make this film based on a screenplay that Dan wrote on spec. Yeah, without making a deal. He just wrote it, sent it to Elmore Leonard, and Leonard loved it and agreed to do it and gave him all his support. He said, go do it. And Dan ended up getting major Hollywood stars in that movie, including Jennifer Aniston. So, you know, pretty amazing. Anyway, Dan will be on for full, pretty close to an hour next week. Much more coming up. So continue, please, tuning in to the podcast. And oh, you know what I did forget to mention? If you go to Filmmaker Magazine, I have an article. It's on there. Just went up yesterday, Monday, on podcasting. So if you go to filmmakermagazine.com, I'm pretty sure very quickly you could find this article if you're interested in reading about, not my podcast, although I do talk about my experience in creating it, but it's more about other podcasts that I listen to, specifically ones that deal with the indie film industry. But there's, you know, I've been getting some nice reaction to it, so go check that out. Filmmakermagazine.com. And thank you, Scott McCauley, for working with me on that. And he is the editor of Filmmaker Magazine, and he was a guest on this show some time ago. Hey, let's bring him back on, you know? It's a great publication. So thanks, everybody, for listening to episode 233, if you can imagine it. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time.